The bus took off. The landing flat was not crowded, but it was far from empty. A man stepped forward and said heartily, "Dr. Harshaw, I'm Tom Bradley, senior executive assistant to the Secretary General. You are to go to Mr. Douglas's office. He will see you before the conference starts." "No." Bradley blinked. "I don't think you understood. These are instructions from the Secretary General." "Oh, he said that it was all right for Mr. Smith to come with you. The man from Mars, I mean." "No, we're going to the conference room. Have somebody lead the way. In the meantime, I have an errand for you. Miriam, that letter."
"But to Dr. Harshaw?"
"I said no. You ought to deliver this to Mr. Douglas at once and fetch his receipt to me." Harshaw signed across the flap of an envelope Miriam handed to him, pressed his thumbprint over the signature, handed it to Bradley. "Tell him that he must read this at once, before the meeting." "But the Secretary General desires..." "The Secretary desires to see that letter. Young man, I am endowed with second sight. I prophesy that you won't be here tomorrow if you waste time getting it to him." Bradley said, "Jim, take over," and left with the letter. Jubal sighed. He had sweated over that letter. Anne and he had been up most of the night preparing draft after draft. Jubal intended to arrive at an open settlement, but he had no intention of taking Douglas by surprise. A man stepped forward in answer to Bradley's order. Jubal sized him up as one of the clever young men on the make who gravitate to those in power and do their dirty work. The man smiled and said, "The name's Jim Sanforth, Doctor. I'm the chief's press secretary. I'll be buffering for you from now on, arranging press interviews and so forth. I'm sorry to say that the conference is not ready. At the last minute, we've had to move to a larger room.
It's my thought that we'll go to that conference room right now."
"Doctor, you don't understand. They are stringing wires and things. The room is swarming with reporters and..."
"Very well. We'll chat with them."
"No, Doctor. I have instructions."
"Youngster, you can take your instructions, fold them until they're all corners, and shove them in your oubliette. We are here for one purpose, a public conference. If the conference is not ready, we'll see the press in the conference room."
"But..."
"You're keeping the man from Mars standing on a windy roof."
Harshaw raised his voice.
"Is there anyone smart enough to lead us to this conference room?"
Sanforth swallowed and said, "Follow me, Doctor." The conference room was alive with newsmen and technicians, but there was a big oval table, chairs, and several smaller tables. Mike was spotted, and Sanforth's protest did not keep the crowd back. Mike's flying wedge of Amazons got him to the big table. Jubal sat him against it with Dorcas and Jill flanking him, and the fair witness and Miriam seated behind him. Then, Jubal made no attempt to fend off questions or pictures. Mike had been told that people would do strange things, and Jubal had warned him to take no sudden actions, such as causing persons or things to go away or stop, unless Jill told him to. Mike took the confusion gravely. Jill was holding his hand, and her touch reassured him. Jubal wanted pictures, the more the better. As for questions, he did not fear them. A week of talking with Mike had convinced him that no reporter could get anything out of Mike without expert help. Mike's habit of answering literally and stopping would nullify attempts to pump him. Most questions Mike answered with, "I do not know," or "Beg pardon?" A Reuters correspondent, anticipating a fight over Mike's status as an heir, tried to sneak in his own test of Mike's competence. "Mr. Smith, what do you know about the laws of inheritance?" Mike knew that he was having trouble grokking the human concept of property, and in particular the ideas of bequest and inheritance. So he stuck to the book, which Jubal recognized as Eli on Inheritance and Bequest, Chapter 1. Mike recited what he had read with precision and no expression for page after page, while the room settled into silence and his interrogator gulped. Jubal let it go on, until every newsman there knew more than he wanted to know about dower and courtesy, consanguinean and uterine, per stirpes and per capita. At last, Jubal said,
"That's enough, Mike."
Mike looked puzzled.
"There is more."
"Later. Does someone have a question on another subject?"
A reporter for a London Sunday paper jumped in with one close to his employer's pocketbook.
"Mr. Smith, we understand you like girls. Have you ever kissed a girl?"
"Yes."
"Did you like it?"
"Yes."
"How did you like it?"
Mike hardly hesitated. "Kissing girls is a goodness," he explained. "It beats the hell out of card games." Their applause frightened him. But he could feel that Jill and Dorcas were not frightened. They were trying to restrain that noisy expression of pleasure which he could not learn. So he calmed his fright and waited. He was saved from further questions and was granted a great joy. He saw a familiar figure entering by a side door. "My brother, Dr. Mahmoud," Mike went on in overpowering excitement, in Martian. The champion's semantician waved and smiled, answered in the same jarring language while hurrying to Mike. The two continued talking in unhuman symbols, Mike in eager torrent, Mahmoud not as rapidly, with sounds like a rhinoceros ramming a steel shed. The newsmen stood it for some time, those who used sound recording it and writers noting it as color. At last one interrupted. "Dr. Mahmoud, what are you saying?" Mahmoud answered in clipped Oxonian. "For the most part I've been saying, slow down, my dear boy, do, please." "And what does he say?" "The rest is personal, private, of no possible interest. Greetings, you know, old friends." He continued to chat, in Martian. Mike was telling his brother all that had happened since he had last seen him so that they might grok closer. But Mike's abstraction of what to tell was Martian in concept, it being concerned primarily with New Water Brothers and the flavor of each, the gentle water that was Chill, the depth of Anne, the strange, not yet fully grokked fact that Jubal tasted now like an egg, then like an old one, but was neither, the ungrokkable vastness of ocean. Mahmoud had less to tell, since less had happened to him by Martian standards. One Dionysian excess, of which he was not proud. One long day spent lying face down in Washington's Suleiman Mosque, the results of which he had not yet grokked and would not discuss. No New Water Brothers. He stopped Mike presently and offered his hand to Jubal. "You're Dr. Harshaw. Valentine Michael thinks he has introduced me, and he has by his rules." Harshaw looked him over as he shook hands. Chap looked like a huntin' shootin' sportin' Britisher, from tweedy, expensively casual clothes to clipped gray mustache. But his skin was swarthy, and the genes for that nose came from somewhere near the Levant. Harshaw did not like fakes, and would choose cold corn pone over the most perfect syntho sirloin. But Mike treated him as a friend. So friend he was, until proved otherwise. To Mahmoud, Harshaw looked like a museum exhibit of what he thought of as a Yank, vulgar, dressed too informally for the occasion, loud, probably ignorant, and almost certainly provincial. A professional man, too, which made it worse, as in Dr. Mahmoud's experience, American professional men were undereducated and narrow, mere technicians. He held a vast distaste for all things American. Their incredible polytheistic babble of religions, their cooking, their manners, their bastard architecture and sickly arts, and their blind, arrogant belief in their superiority long after their sun had set. Their women most of all, their immodest, assertive women with gaunt, starved bodies, which nevertheless reminded him disturbingly of houris. Four of them crowded around Valentine Michael, at a meeting which should be all male. But Valentine Michael offered these people, including these ubiquitous female creatures, offered them proudly and eagerly as his water brothers, thereby laying on Mahmoud an obligation more binding than that owed to the sons of one's father's brother, since Mahmoud understood the Martian term for such accretive relationships from observation of Martians, and did not need to translate it inadequately as catenative assemblage, nor even as things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. He had seen Martians at home. He knew their poverty by Earth standards. He had dipped into, and had guessed at far more of, their cultural wealth, and grokked the supreme value that Martians placed on interpersonal relationships. Well, there was nothing else for it. He had shared water with Valentine Michael, and now he must justify his friend's faith in him. He hoped that these Yanks were not complete bounders. So he smiled warmly. "Yes, Valentine Michael has explained to me, most proudly, that you were all in..." Mahmoud used one word of Martian. "To him."
Nay.
What a brotherhood. You understand?
Agrocket.
Mahmud doubted if Harshaw did, but went on smoothly. Since I am in that relationship to him, I must ask to be considered a member of the family. I know your name, Doctor, and I have guessed that this must be Mr. Caxton. I have seen your face pictured at the head of your column, Mr. Caxton. But let me see if I have the young lady straight. This must be Anne.
Yes, but she's cloaked.
Yes, of course, I'll pay my respects to her later. Harshaw introduced him to the others. And Jill startled him by addressing him with the correct honorific for a water brother, pronouncing it 3 octaves higher than any Martian would talk, but with sore throat purity of accent. It was one of a dozen words she could speak out of 100 odd that she was beginning to understand, but this one she had down pat, because it was used to her and by her many times each day. Dr. Mahmud's eyes widened. Perhaps these people were not mere uncircumcised barbarians. His young friend did have strong intuition. Instantly, he offered Jill the correct honorific in response and bowed over her hand. Jill saw that Mike was delighted. She managed to croak the shortest of 9 forms by which a water brother may return the response. Although she did not grok it, and would not have considered suggesting, in English, the nearest human biological equivalent, certainly not to a man she had just met. Mahmud, who did understand it, took its symbolic meaning rather than its humanly impossible literal meaning, and spoke rightly in response. Jill had passed her limit. She did not understand his answer, and could not reply even in English. But she got an inspiration. At intervals around the table were water pitchers, each with its clump of glasses. She got a pitcher and tumbler, filled the latter. She looked Mahmud in the eye, said earnestly, "Limit." She did not understand his answer, and could not reply, even in English. But she got an inspiration. At intervals around the table were water pitchers, each with its clump of glasses. She got a pitcher and tumbler, filled the latter. She looked Mahmud in the eye, said earnestly, "Water, our nest is yours." She touched it to her lips and handed it to Mahmud. He answered in Martian, saw that she did not understand, and translated, "Who shares water, shares all." He took a sip and started to return it, checked himself, and offered Harshaw the glass. Jubal said,
"I can't speak Martian, son. But thanks for water. May you never be thirsty."
He drank a third of it.
"Ah!"
He passed it to Ben. Caxton looked at Mahmud and said soberly,
"Grow closer. With water of life, we grow closer."
He sipped it and passed it to Dorcas. In spite of precedents already set, Dorcas hesitated. "Dr. Mahmud, do you know how serious this is to Mike?"
"I do, miss."
"Well, it's just as serious to us. You understand? You grok?"
"I grok its fullness, or I would have refused to drink."
"All right. May you always drink deep. May our eggs share a nest." Tears started down her cheeks. She drank and passed the glass hastily to Miriam. Miriam whispered, "Pull yourself together, kid." Then spoke to Mike. "With water we welcome our brother." Then added to Mahmud, "Nest, water, life." She drank. "Our brother." She offered him the glass. Mahmud drank what was left and spoke, but in Arabic. "And if ye mingle your affairs with theirs, then they are your brothers."
"Amen," Jubal agreed.
Dr. Mahmud looked quickly at him, decided not to inquire whether Harshaw had understood. This was not the place to say anything which might lead to unbottling his own troubles, his doubts. Nevertheless, he felt warmed in his soul, as always, by water ritual, even though it reeked of heresy. His thoughts were cut short by the assistant chief of protocol bustling up.
"You're Dr. Mahmud. You belong on the far side, doctor. Follow me."
Mahmud smiled. "No, I belong here. Dorcas, may I pull up a chair and sit between you and Valentine, Michael?"
"Certainly, doctor, I'll scrunch over."
The ACFP was almost tapping his foot.
Dr. Mahmood, please. The chart places you on the other side of the room. The Secretary General will be here any moment, and the place is still simply swarming with reporters and goodness knows who else, and I don't know what I'm going to do.
Then do it someplace else, Bob, Jubal suggested.
What? Who are you? Are you on the list? He worriedly consulted a seating chart.
Who are you? Jubal answered. The head waiter? I'm Jubal Harshaw. If my name is not on that list, you can tear it up. Look, Bust, if the man from Mars wants Dr. Mahmood by him, that settles it.
But he can't sit here. Seats at the conference table are reserved for high ministers, chiefs of delegations, high court justices, and equal ranks. And I don't know how I can squeeze them in if any more show up. And the man from Mars, of course.
Of course, Jubal agreed.
And, of course, Dr. Mahmood has to be near the Secretary General, just back of him, so that he'll be ready to interpret. I must say you're not being helpful.
I'll help.
Jubal plucked the paper out of the official's hand.
Let me see now. The man from Mars will sit opposite the Secretary General, near where he happens to be. Then,
Jubal took a pencil and attacked the chart.
This half, from here to here, belongs to the man from Mars.
Jubal scratched cross marks and joined them with a thick black arc, then began scratching out names assigned to that side of the table.
That takes care of half of your work, because I'll seat anybody on our side.
The protocol officer was too shocked to talk. His mouth worked, but only noises came out. Jubal looked at him mildly.
Something the matter? Oh, I forgot to make it official.
He scrawled under his amendments, J. Harshaw for V.M. Smith.
Trot back to your top sergeant, son, and show him that. Tell him to check his rule book on official visits from heads of friendly planets.
The man opened his mouth, left without stopping to close it. He returned on the heels of an older man. The newcomer said in a no-nonsense manner,
Dr. Harshaw, I'm LaRue, chief of protocol. Do you actually need half the main table? I understood that your delegation was quite small. That's beside the point.
LaRue smiled briefly.
I'm afraid it's not beside the point. I'm at my wit's end for space. Almost every official of first rank has elected to be present. If you're expecting more people, though I do wish you had notified me, I'll have a table placed behind these two seats reserved for Mr. Smith and yourself.
No.
I'm afraid that's the way it must be. I'm sorry.
So am I, for you, because if half the main table is not reserved for Mars, we are leaving. Tell the Secretary General you busted up his conference by being rude to the man from Mars.
Surely you don't mean that.
Didn't you get my message?
Well, I took it as a jest. I can't afford to joke, son.
Smith is either top man from another planet paying an official visit to the top man of this planet, in which case he is entitled to all the side boys and dancing girls you can dig up, or he is just a tourist and gets no official courtesies of any sort. You can't have it both ways. Look around you, count the officials of first rank, as you call them, and guess whether they would be here if, in their minds, Smith is just a tourist.
LaRue said slowly,
There's no precedent.
Jubal snorted.
I saw the chief of delegation from the Lunar Republic come in. Go tell him there's no precedent.
Then Duck, I hear he's got a quick temper. But son, I'm an old man, and I had a short night, and it's none of my business to teach you your job. Tell Mr. Douglas that we'll see him another day, when he's ready to receive us properly. Come on, Mike.
He started to pry himself painfully out of his chair. LaRue said hastily,
No, Dr. Harshaw, we'll clear this side of the table. I'll do something. It's yours.
That's better.
Harshaw remained poised to get up.
But where's the flag of Mars? And how about honors?
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Never seen a day when I had so much trouble with plain English. Look, see that Federation banner back where the Secretary is going to sit? Where's one over here for Mars?
LaRue blinked.
I must admit you've taken me by surprise. I didn't know the Martians used flags.
They don't. But you couldn't possibly wop up what they use for high state occasions.
Nor could I, boy, but that's beside the point.
So we'll let you off easy and take an attempt for the deed. Piece of paper, Miriam. Now, like this.
Harshaw drew a rectangle, sketched in the traditional human symbol for Mars, a circle with an arrow leading out to upper right.
Make the field in white and the sigil of Mars in red. Should be sewed in silk, of course, but with a sheet and some paint, any Boy Scout could improvise one. Were you a scout?
Some time ago.
Good, you know the scout's motto. Now, about honors. You expect to play Hail to Sovereign Peace as the secretary comes in?
Oh, we must.
Then you want to follow it with the anthem for Mars.
I don't see how I can, even if there is one. We don't have it.
Dr. Harshaw, be reasonable. Look, son, I am being reasonable. We came here for a small, informal meeting. We find you've turned it into a circus. Well, if you're going to have a circus, you've got to have elephants. Now, we realize you can't play Martian music any more than a boy with a tin whistle can play a symphony. But you can play a symphony. The Nine Planet Symphony. Grokket. I mean, do you catch on? Have the tape cut in at the beginning of the Mars movement. Play that. Or enough bars to let the theme be recognized.
LaRue looked thoughtful.
Yes, I suppose we could.
But Dr. Harshaw, I don't see how I can promise sovereign honors even on this improvised scale. I don't think I have the authority.
Nor the guts, Harshaw said bitterly. Well, we didn't want a circus. So tell Mr. Douglas that we'll be back when he's not so busy. Been nice chatting with you, son. Stop by the secretary's office and say hello when we come back, if you're still here.
He again went through the slow, apparently painful act of being too old and feeble to get out of a chair easily. LaRue said, Dr. Harshaw, please, don't leave. The secretary won't come in until I send word that we are ready, so let me see what I can do. Yes?
Harshaw relaxed with a grunt. Suit yourself. One more thing while you're here. I heard a ruckus a moment ago when I could catch some crew members of the Champion wanted in. They're friends of Smith, so let them in. We'll accommodate them. Help to fill up this side of the table.
Harshaw sighed and rubbed a kidney.
Very well, sir. LaRue agreed stiffly and left.
Miriam whispered, Boss, did you sprain your back doing those handstands night before last?
Quiet, girl, or I'll paddle you.
With satisfaction, Jubal surveyed the room, which was continuing to fill with high officials. He had told Douglas that he wanted a small, informal talk, knowing that the announcement would fetch the powerful and power-hungry as light attracts moths. And now he felt sure Mike was about to be treated as a sovereign by those nabobs, with the world watching. Let him try to roust the boy around after this. Sandforth was shooing out newsmen, and the unfortunate assistant chief of protocol was jittering like a nervous babysitter in his attempt to play musical chairs with too few chairs and too many notables. They continued pouring in, and Jubal concluded that Douglas had never intended to convene earlier than 11, and that everyone else had been informed. The hour given Jubal was to permit the private pre-conference meeting that he had refused. Well, the delay suited Jubal. The leader of the Eastern Coalition came in. Mr. Kung was, by choice, not chief of delegation for his nation. His status under strict protocol was merely that of assemblyman. But Jubal was not surprised to see the assistant chief of protocol drop everything and rush to seat Douglas's chief political enemy at the main table near the seat reserved for the secretary general. It reinforced Jubal's opinion that Douglas was no fool. Dr. Nelson, surgeon of the Champion, and Captain Van Tromp, her skipper, came in together and were greeted with delight by Mike. Jubal was pleased, as it gave the boy something to do under the cameras instead of sitting like a dummy. Jubal made use of the disturbance to rearrange seating. He placed Mike opposite the Secretary General's chair, and himself took the chair on Mike's left, where he could touch Mike. Since Mike had foggy notions of human manners, Jubal had arranged signals as imperceptible as those used in putting a high school horse through dressage. Stand up, sit down, bow, shake hands. Except that Mike was not a horse, and his training had required only 5 minutes to achieve perfection. Mahmood broke away from his shipmates and spoke to Jubal. Doctor, the skipper and the surgeon are also water brothers of our brother, and Valentine Michael wanted to confirm it by again using ritual, all of us. I told him to wait. Do you approve?
Eh? Yes, certainly. Not in this mob.
Damn it, how many water brothers did Mike have?
Maybe you three can come with us when we leave, and have a bite and a talk in private.
I shall be honored. I feel sure the other two will come also.
Good. Dr. Mahmood, Do you know of any other brothers of our young brother who are likely to show up?
No, not from the champion. There are no more.
Mahmud decided not to ask the complimentary question, as it would hint at how disconcerted he had been, at first, to discover his own conjugational commitments.
I'll tell Sven and the old man.
Harshaw saw the papal nuncio come in, saw him seated at the main table, and smiled inwardly. If that long-eared debit LaRue had any lingering doubts about the official nature of this meeting, he would do well to forget them. A man tapped Harshaw on the shoulder.
Is this where the man from Mars hangs out?
Yes,
agreed Jubal.
I'm Tom Boone, Senator Boone, that is, and I've got a message for him from Supreme Bishop Digby.
Jubal put his cortex into emergency high speed.
I'm Jubal Harshaw, Senator.
He signaled Mike to stand and shake hands.
And this is Mr. Smith. Mike, this is Senator Boone.
How do you do, Senator Boone? Mike said in perfect dancing school form. He looked at Boone with interest. He had it straightened out for him that Senator did not mean old one, as the word seemed to shape. Nevertheless, he was interested in seeing a senator. He decided that he did not grok it.
Pretty well, thank you, Mr. Smith. I won't take up your time. They seem about to get this shindig started. Mr. Smith, Supreme Bishop Digby sent me to give you a personal invite to attend services at Archangel Foster Tabernacle of the New Revelation.
Beg pardon?
Jubal moved in.
Senator, as you know many things here, everything is new to the man from Mars. But it happens that Mr. Smith has seen one of your services by stereovision.
Not the same thing.
I know. He expressed great interest and asked many questions, many of which I could not answer.
Boone looked keenly at him.
You're not one of the faithful?
I must admit I am not.
Come along yourself. Always hope for a sinner.
Thank you, I will.
I surely will, friend. I won't let Mike go into your trap alone. Next Sunday, I'll tell Bishop Digby.
Next Sunday, if possible, Jubal corrected. We might be in jail.
Boone grinned.
There's always that, ain't there? Send word around to me or the Supreme Bishop, and you won't stay in long.
He looked around the room.
Kind of short on chairs. Not much chance for a plain senator with all those muckamucks elbowing each other.
Perhaps you would honor us by joining us, Senator?
Jubal answered smoothly.
At this table?
Eh? Well, thank you, sir. Don't mind if I do. Ringside seat.
That is, Harshaw added, if you don't mind the implications of being seen seated with the Mars delegation, we aren't trying to crowd you into an embarrassing situation.
Boone barely hesitated.
Not at all. Matter of fact, between you and I, the bishop is very, very interested in this young fellow.
Fine. There's a chair by Captain Van Tromp. Probably you know him.
Van Tromp? Sure, old friends. Know him well. Met him at the reception.
Senator Boone nodded at Smith, swaggered down, and seated himself. Fewer were getting past the guards. Jubal watched one argument over seating, and the longer he watched, the more he fidgeted. At last he could not sit still and watch this indecency go on, so he spoke with Mike, made sure that if Mike did not understand why, at least he knew what Jubal wanted.
Jubal, I will do. Thanks, son.
Jubal got up and approached a group of three, the assistant chief of protocol, the chief of the Uruguayan delegation, and a man who seemed angry and baffled. The Uruguayan was saying,
Seat him, then you must find seats for all local chiefs of state, 80 or more. This is Federation soil, and no chief of state has precedence over any other. If exceptions are made...
Jubal interrupted by addressing the third man.
Sir.
He waited long enough to gain attention, plunged on.
The man from Mars has instructed me to ask you to do him the great honor of sitting with him, if your presence is not required elsewhere.
The man looked startled, then smiled broadly. Why, yes, that would be satisfactory. The other two, palace official and Uruguayan dignitary, started to object. Jubal turned his back.
Let's hurry, sir. We have very little time.
He had seen men coming in with what appeared to be a stand for a Christmas tree and a bloody sheet, but what was certainly the Martian flag. As they hurried, Mike stood up and was waiting. Chubal said,
"Sir, permit me to present Valentine Michael Smith. Michael, the President of the United States."
Mike bowed very low. There was barely time to seat him on Mike's right while the improvised flag was being set up. Music sounded, everyone stood, and a voice proclaimed, "The Secretary General." Chapter 20.
Jubal had considered having Mike remain seated while Douglas came in, but had rejected the idea. He was not trying to place Mike higher than Douglas, but merely to establish that the meeting was between equals. So when he stood up, he signaled Mike to do so. Great doors at the back of the hall opened at the first strains of Hail to Sovereign Peace, and Douglas came in. He went to his chair and started to sit down. Instantly, Jubal signaled Mike to sit down, the result being that Mike and the Secretary General sat down simultaneously, with a respectful pause before anyone else did so. Jubal held his breath. Had LaRue done it? He hadn't quite promised. The fortissimo toxin of the Mars movement filled the room, the war god theme that startles even an audience expecting it. With his eyes on Douglas, and Douglas looking back at him, Jubal was up out of his chair like a recruit snapping to attention. Douglas stood, not as quickly, but promptly. But Mike did not. Jubal had not signaled him. He sat, unembarrassed by the fact that everyone else got back on his feet when the Secretary General did. Mike did not understand any of it, and was content to do what his water brother wanted. Jubal had puzzled over this after he had demanded the Martian anthem. If the demand was met, what should Mike do? The answer depended on what role Mike was playing in this comedy. The music stopped. On Jubal's signals, Mike stood up, bowed quickly, and sat down, seating himself about as the Secretary General and the rest were seated. They all sat down more quickly this time, as no one missed the glaring point that Mike had remained seated through the anthem. Jubal sighed with relief. He had gotten away with it. Many years earlier, he had seen one of the vanishing tribe of royalty, a reigning queen, receive a parade, and he had noticed that the royal lady bowed after her anthem was played. That is, she had acknowledged a salute offered to her sovereign self. But the head of a democracy stands for his nation's anthem like any citizen. He is not a sovereign. As Jubal had pointed out, one couldn't have it two ways. Either Mike was a private citizen, in which case this gymkhana should never have been held, or by the theory inherent in the Larkin decision, the kid was sovereign all by his lonesome. Jubal felt tempted to offer LaRue a pinch of snuff. Well, the point had not been missed by one. The papal nuncio kept his face straight, but his eyes were twinkling. Douglas started to speak.
"Mr. Smith, we are honored and happy to have you as our guest. We hope that you will consider Earth your home quite as much as the planet of your birth, our neighbor, our good neighbor, Mars."
He went on in rounded, pleasant periods. Mike was welcomed, but whether as a sovereign, as a tourist, or as a citizen returning home, was impossible to tell. Jubal watched Douglas, looking for some sign that would show how Douglas had taken the letter Jubal had sent to him, but Douglas never looked at him. Presently, Douglas concluded, having said nothing, and said it very well. Jubal said,
"Now, Mike."
Smith addressed the Secretary General in Martian. He cut it off and said gravely, "Mr. Secretary General of the Federation of Free Nations of the Planet Earth." Then went on again in Martian. Then in English, "We thank you for our welcome here today. We bring greetings to the peoples of Earth from the ancient ones of Mars." And shifted again into Martian. Jubal felt that ancient ones was a good touch. It carried more bulge than old ones, and Mike had not objected. It had been Jill's idea to alternate a Martian version with the English one, and Jubal admitted with warm pleasure that her gimmick puffed up a formal little speech as devoid of content as a campaign promise, into something as rollingly impressive as Wagnerian opera, and as hard to figure out. It didn't matter to Mike. He could insert the Martian as easily as he could memorize and recite the English. If it would please his water brothers to say these sayings, it made Mike happy.
Someone touched Jubal's shoulder, shoved an envelope in his hand, and whispered, "From the Secretary General." Jubal looked up, saw that it was Bradley, hurrying silently away. Jubal opened the envelope, glanced inside. The note was one word. Yes. And had been signed with J.E.D. in the famous green ink. Jubal looked up, found Douglas's eyes on him. Jubal nodded, and Douglas looked away. The conference was over. All that remained was to let the world know it. Mike concluded the sonorous nullities. Jubal heard his own words. "Growing closer with mutual benefit to both worlds, and each race according to its own nature." Douglas then thanked the man from Mars, briefly but warmly. Jubal stood up.
"Mr. Secretary General?"
"Yes, Dr. Harshaw?"
"Mr. Smith is here in a dual role. Like some visiting prince in the history of our own great race, traveling by caravan and sail across uncharted vastnesses to a distant realm, he brings the good wishes of the ancient powers of Mars. But he is also a human being, a citizen of the Federation of the United States of America. As such, he has rights and properties and obligations."
Jubal shook his head.
"Pesky ones. As attorney, for his capacity as a citizen and a human being, I have been puzzling over his affairs, and I've not even managed a complete list of what he owns, much less decide what to tell tax collectors."
Jubal stopped to wheeze.
"I'm an old man. I might not live to complete the task. You know that my client has no business experience in the human sense. Martians do these things differently. But he is a young man of great intelligence. The whole world knows that his parents were geniuses, and blood will tell. There's no doubt that in a few years he could, if he wished, do nicely on his own without the aid of one old broken-down lawyer. But his affairs need attention today. Business won't wait. But he is more eager to learn the history and arts and ways of the people of this, his second home, than he is to bury himself in debentures and stock issues and royalties. And I think in this he is wise. Mr. Smith possesses a direct wisdom that continues to astonish me, and astonishes all who meet him. When I explained the trouble, he looked at me with a clear gaze and said, 'That's no problem, Jubal. We'll ask Mr. Douglas.'"
Jubal paused and said anxiously,
"The rest is personal business, Mr. Secretary. Should I see you privately and let these ladies and gentlemen go home?"
"Go ahead, Dr. Harshaw," Douglas added. "Protocol is dispensed with. Anyone who wishes to leave, please feel free to do so."
No one left.
"All right," Jubal went on. "I can wrap it up in one sentence. Mr. Smith wants to appoint you his attorney in fact, with full power to handle all his business affairs."
Douglas looked convincingly astonished.
"That's a tall order, Doctor."
"I know it is, sir. I pointed out to him that you are the busiest man on this planet and didn't have time for his affairs."
Jubal shook his head and smiled.
"I'm afraid I didn't impress him. Seems on Mars the busier person is, the more he is expected of him. Mr. Smith simply said, 'We can ask him.' So I'm asking you. Of course, we don't expect an answer offhand. That's another Martian trait. Martians are never in a hurry. Nor are they inclined to make things complicated. No bond, no auditing, none of that claptrap. A written power of attorney if you want it, but it does not matter to him. He would do it just as readily, orally, and right now. That's another Martian trait. If a Martian trusts you, he trusts you all the way. Oh, I should add, Mr. Smith is not making this request of the Secretary General. He's asking a favor of Joseph Edgerton Douglas, you personally. If you retire from public life, it will not affect this. Your successor in office doesn't figure in it. It's you he trusts, not just whoever happens to occupy the Octagon office in this palace."
Douglas nodded.
"Regardless of my answer, I feel honored and humble. Because if you decline to serve or can't serve or take on this chore and want to drop it later or anything, Mr. Smith has his second choice. Ben Caxton it is. Stand up, Ben. Let people see you. And if both you and Caxton can't or won't, his next choice is, well, I guess we'll reserve that for the moment. Just let it rest that there are successive choices. Let me see now. Jubal looked fuddled. I'm out of the habit of talking on my feet. Miriam, where's that paper we listed things on?
Jubal accepted a sheet from her and added,
Better give me the other copies, too.
She passed over a thick stack of sheets.
This is a memo we prepared for you, sir. Or for Caxton, if it turns out that way. Let me see. Oh, yes. Steward to pay himself what he thinks the job is worth, but not less than... Well, a considerable sum. Nobody else's business, really. Steward to deposit monies in a drawing account for living expenses of party of the first part. Yes, I thought maybe you would want to use the Bank of Shanghai, say, as depository, and, say, Lloyd's as your business agent, or the other way around, just to protect your name and fame. But Mr. Smith won't hear of fixed instructions. Just an unlimited assignment of power, revocable by either side. But I won't read all this. That's why we wrote it out.
Jubal peered vacantly around.
Miriam, trot around and give this to the Secretary General. That's a good girl. These other copies, I'll leave them here. You may want to pass them out. Oh, you may need them yourself. Oh, I'd better give one to Mr. Caxton. Here, Ben.
Jubal looked anxiously around.
I guess that's all, Mr. Secretary. Did you have anything to say to us?
Just a moment. Mr. Smith?
Yes, Mr. Douglas?
Is this what you want? Do you want me to do what it says on this paper?
Jubal held his breath, avoided glancing at his client. Mike had been coached to expect such a question, but there had been no telling what form it would take, nor any way to tell how Mike's literal interpretations could trip them.
Yes, Mr. Douglas.
Mike's voice rang out in the room, and in a billion rooms around the planet.
You want me to handle your business affairs?
Please, Mr. Douglas. It would be a goodness. I thank you. Douglas blinked.
Well, that's clear enough. Doctor, I'll reserve my answer, but you shall have it promptly. Thank you, sir, for myself as well as for my client.
Douglas started to stand up. Assemblyman Kung's voice interrupted.
One moment. How about the Larkin decision?
Jubal grabbed it.
Ah, yes, the Larkin decision. I've heard a lot of nonsense about the Larkin decision, mostly from irresponsible persons. Mr. Kung, what about it?
I'm asking you, or your client, or the Secretary General.
Jubal said gently,
Shall I speak, Mr. Secretary?
Please do.
Very well.
Jubal took out a handkerchief and blew his nose in a prolonged blast, a minor chord 3 octaves below middle C. He fixed Kung with his eye and said solemnly,
Mr. Assemblyman, I'll address you, because I know it is unnecessary to address it to the government in the person of the secretary. A long time ago when I was a little boy, another boy and I formed a club. Since we had a club, we had to have rules, and the first rule we passed, unanimously, was that henceforth we could call our mothers Crosspatch. Silly, of course, but we were very young. Mr. Kung, can you deduce the outcome?
I won't guess, Dr. Harshaw.
I implemented our Crosspatch decision just once. Once was enough, and it saved my chum from the same mistake. All it got me was my bottom warmed with a peach switch. And that was the end of the Crosspatch decision.
Jubal cleared his throat.
Knowing that someone was certain to raise this non-existent issue, I tried to explain the Larkin decision to my client. He had trouble realizing that anyone could think that this legal fiction would apply to Mars. After all, Mars is inhabited by an old and wise race, much older than yours, sir, and possibly wiser. But when he did understand it, he was amused. Just that, sir. Tolerantly amused. Once. Just once. I underrated my mother's power to punish impudence. That lesson was cheap. But this planet cannot afford such a lesson on a planetary scale. Before we parcel out lands which do not belong to us, it behooves us to be very sure what peach switches are hanging in the Martian kitchen.
Kung looked unconvinced. Dr. Harshaw, if the Larkin decision is no more than a small boy's folly, why were sovereign honors rendered to Mr. Smith?
Jubal shrugged. That should be put to the government, not to me. But I can tell you how I interpreted them. As elementary politeness to the ancient ones of Mars.
Please?
Mr. Kung, those honors were no hollow echo of the Larkin decision. In a fashion beyond human experience, Mr. Smith is the planet Mars.
Kung did not blink.
Continue.
Or rather, the Martian race. In Smith's person, the ancient ones of Mars are visiting us. Honors to him are honors to them. And harm done to him is harm to them. This is true in a literal, but utterly unhuman sense. It was prudent for us to render honors to our neighbors today, but the wisdom has nothing to do with the Larkin decision. No responsible person has argued that the Larkin precedent applies to an inhabited planet. I venture to say that none ever will.
Jubal looked up, as if asking heaven for help.
But Mr. Kung, be assured that the ancient rulers of Mars notice how we treat their ambassador. Honors rendered them through him were a gracious symbol. I am certain that the government of this planet showed wisdom thereby. In time, you will learn that it was a prudent act as well.
Kung answered blandly. Doctor, if you were trying to frighten me, you have not succeeded.
I did not expect to. But fortunately for the welfare of this planet, your opinion did not control.
Jubal turned to Douglas.
Mr. Secretary, this is the longest public appearance I've made in years, and I am fatigued. Could we recess while we await your decision?
Chapter 21. The meeting adjourned. Jubal found his intention of getting his flock quickly away balked by the American president and Senator Boone. Both realized the enhanced value of being seen on intimate terms with the man from Mars, and both were aware that the eyes of the world were on them. Other hungry politicos were closing in. Jubal said quickly,
Mr. President, Senator, we're leaving at once to have lunch. Can you join us?
He reflected that two in private would be easier to handle than two dozen in public, and he had to get Mike away before anything came unstuck. To his relief, both had duties elsewhere. Jubal found himself promising not only to fetch Mike to that obscene Fosterite service, but also to bring him to the White House. Well, the boy could get sick if necessary.
Please, girls.
Mike was convoyed to the roof, and creating a bow wave with her height, her Valkyrie beauty, her impressive cloak. Jubal, Ben, and the officers from the Champion covered the rear. Larry and the bus were waiting. Minutes later, the driver left them on the roof of the new Mayflower. Newsmen caught up with them there, but the girls guarded Mike on down to a suite Duke had taken. They were enjoying it. Miriam and Dorcas displayed ferocity that reminded Jubal of a cat defending her young. A reporter that closed within 3 feet courted a spiked instep. They found their corridor patrolled by SS troopers and an officer outside their suite. Jubal's back hair rose, but he realized that their presence meant that Douglas was carrying out the bargain. The letter Jubal had sent before the conference had included a plea to Douglas to use his power to protect Mike's privacy so that the unfortunate lad could lead a normal life. So Jubal called out,
Jill, keep Mike under control. It's okay.
Right, boss.
The officer at the door saluted. Jubal glanced at him.
Well, howdy, Major. Busted down any doors lately?
Major Block turned red and did not answer. Jubal wondered if the assignment was punishment. Duke was waiting inside. Jubal said,
Sit down, gentlemen. How about it, Duke?
Duke shrugged.
Nobody has bugged this suite since I took it. But, boss, any dumb can be bugged so you can't find it. Yes, yes, I didn't mean that. I mean, how about our supplies? I'm hungry, boy, and thirsty, and we've got 3 more for lunch. Oh, that. The stuff was unloaded under my eyes. I put it in the pantry. You've got a suspicious nature, boss. You'd better acquire one if you want to live as long as I have. I don't hanker to.
matter of taste. I've had a good time on the whole. Get cracking, girls. First one back with the drink for me skips her next turn up front. After all guests, I mean. Do sit down, gentlemen. Sven, what's your favorite poison? Aquavit? Larry, duck out and buy a couple of bottles. And Bowles gin for the captain. Hold it, Jubal, Nelson said. I'd rather have scotch.
Me too, agreed Von Tromp.
Got enough to drown a horse. Dr. Mahmoud?
If you'd prefer soft drinks, I'm sure the girls tuck some in.
Mahmoud looked wistful. I should not be tempted by strong drink.
Allow me.
Jubal looked him over.
Son, you've been under nervous strain. Having no meprobinate, I'm forced to substitute 2 ounces of 90-proof ethanol. Repeat as needed. Any particular flavor?
Mahmoud smiled. Thank you, Doctor. But I'll sin my own sins. Gin, please, with water on the side. Or vodka. Or whatever is available.
Or medicinal alcohol, Nelson added. Don't let him kid you, Jubal. Stinky drinks anything, and regrets it.
I do regret it, Mahmoud said earnestly. It is sinful.
Don't needle him, Sven, Jubal said brusquely. If Stinky gets more mileage out of his sins by regretting, that's his business. To each his own.
How about victuals, Stinky? And stuff to ham in one of those hampers, and there may be other unclean items. Shall I check?
Mahmoud shook his head. I'm not a traditionalist, Jubal. That legislation was given long ago for the needs of the time. The times are different now. Jubal suddenly looked sad.
Yes, but for the better.
Never mind, this too shall pass. Eat what you will, my brother. God forgives necessity.
Thank you, but I often do not eat in the middle of the day.
Better eat or ethanol will do more than relax you. Besides, these kids who work for me may sometimes misspell words, but they are all superb cooks.
Miriam was entering with a tray of drinks, orders filled while Jubal ranted. Boss, she broke in, will you put that in writing?
What?
He whirled around.
Snooping. Stay after school and write 1,000 times. I will not flap my ears at private conversations.
Yes, boss. This is for you, Captain. And you, Dr. Nelson. And yours, Dr. Mahmoud. Water on the side, you said.
Yes, Miriam. Thank you.
Usual Harshaw service, sloppy but fast. Here's yours, boss.
You put water in it.
Anne's orders. You're too tired to have it on the rocks.
Jubal looked long-suffering. See what I put up with, gentlemen. We should never have put shoes on them. Miriam, make that 1,000 times in Sanskrit.
Yes, boss. She patted him on the head. Go ahead and have your tizzy, dear. You've earned it. We're proud of you.
Back to the kitchen, woman. Has everybody got a drink? Where's Ben?
They have by now. Ben is phoning in his column. His drink is at his elbow.
Very well. You may back out quietly. And send Mike in. Gentlemen, make aloha paole.
He drank. They joined him. Mike's helping. I think he's going to be a butler when he grows up.
I thought you had left. Send him in anyhow. Dr. Nelson wants to examine him.
No hurry, put in the ship's surgeon. Jubal, this is excellent scotch. But what was the toast?
Sorry, Polynesian. May our friendship be everlasting. Called it a footnote to the water ceremony. By the way, gentlemen, Larry and Duke are water brothers to Mike, too, but don't let it fret you. They can't cook, but they're the sort to have at your back in a dark alley.
If you vouch for them, Jubal, Van Tromp assured him, admit them and tile the door. But let's drink to the girls.
Sven, what's that toast to the flickers?
No one to pretty girls everywhere. Let's drink to the 4 who are here. Skull.
They drank to their female water brothers, and Nelson continued.
Jubal, where do you find them?
Raise them in my own cellar. Then when I've got them trained, some city slicker comes along and marries them. It's a losing game.
I see how you suffer, Nelson said sympathetically.
I do. I trust all you gentlemen are married.
2 were. Mahmoud was not. Jubal looked at him bleakly.
Would you have the grace to discorporate? After lunch, I wouldn't want you to do it on an empty stomach.
I'm no threat. I'm a permanent bachelor.
Come, sir, I saw Dorcas making eyes at you, and you were purring.
I'm safe, I assure you.
Mahmud thought of telling Jubal that he would never marry out of his faith, decided that a Gentile would take it amiss.
But Jubal, don't make a suggestion like that to Mike. He wouldn't grok that you were joking, and you might have a corpse on your hands.
I don't know that Mike can think himself dead, but he would try.
I'm sure he can, Nelson said firmly. Doctor, Jubal, I mean, have you noticed anything odd about Mike's metabolism? Let me put it this way. I haven't noticed anything about his metabolism that is not odd. Exactly.
Jubal turned to Mahmud.
Don't worry that I might invite Mike to suicide. I grok that he doesn't grok joking.
Jubal blinked.
But I don't grok. Stinky, you speak Martian?
A little.
You speak it fluently, I heard you. Do you grok?
Mahmud looked thoughtful.
No. Grok is the most important word in the language, and I expect to spend years trying to understand it. But I don't expect to be successful. You need to think in Martian to grok the word grok. Perhaps you have noticed that Mike takes a veering approach to some ideas.
Have I? My throbbing head.
Mine, too.
Food, announced Jubal. Lunch, and about time. Girls, put it where we can reach it and maintain a respectful silence. Go on, Doctor. Or does Mike's presence make it better to postpone it?
Not at all.
Mahmud spoke in Martian to Mike. Mike answered, smiled sunnily. His expression became blank again, and he applied himself to food.
I told him what I was trying to do, and he told me that I would speak rightly. This was not opinion, but a fact, a necessity. I hope that if I fail to, he will notice and tell me. But I doubt if he will. Mike thinks in Martian, and this gives him a different map. You follow me?
I grok it, agreed Jubal. Language itself shapes a man's basic ideas.
Yes, but... Doctor, you speak Arabic?
Eh? Badly, admitted Jubal. Put in a while as an army surgeon in North Africa. I still read it because I prefer the words of the Prophet in the original.
Proper. The Quran cannot be translated. The map changes, no matter how one tries. You understand, then, how difficult I found English. It was not alone that my native language has simpler inflections. The map changed. English is the largest human tongue. Its variety, subtlety, and irrational idiomatic complexity make it possible to say things in English which cannot be said in any other language. It almost drove me crazy until I learned to think in it, and that put a new map of the world on top of the one I grew up with. A better one, perhaps. Certainly a more detailed one. But there are things which can be said in Arabic that cannot be said in English.
Jubal nodded.
That's why I've kept up my reading.
Yes. But Martian is so much more complex than is English, and so wildly different in how it abstracts its picture of the universe, that English and Arabic might as well be one language. An Englishman and an Arab can learn to think each other's language. But I'm not certain that it will ever be possible for us to think in Martian, other than the way Mike learned it. Or we can learn pidgin Martian. That is what I speak. Take this word grok. Its literal meaning, one which I suspect goes back to the origin of the Martian race as thinking creatures, and which throws light on their whole map, is easy. Grok means to drink.
Huh, said Jubal. Mike never says grok when he's just talking about drinking.
Just a moment.
Mahmud spoke to Mike in Martian. Mike looked faintly surprised.
Grok is drink.
But Mike would have agreed, Mahmud went on, if I had named 100 other English words, words which we think of as different concepts, even antithetical concepts. Grok means all of these. It means fear, it means love, it means hate, proper hate, for by the Martian map you cannot hate anything unless you grok it, understand it so thoroughly that you merge with it and it merges with you, Then can you hate? By hating yourself.